it to put our crypts in cover, subways with inscriptions, and it's good enough for me. Oh,
give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good.
Oh, let's play on. Pray with those old druids. They drink fermented fluids, waltzing naked through the woods, and it's good enough for me. Oh,
give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion, it's good enough for me.
Hare Krishna, he must laugh on to see me dressed in saffron with my hair that's only half on, and it's good enough for me.
Oh, give me that old time religion,
I will rise at early morning when my Lord gives me the warning that the solar age is dawning, and that's good enough for me.
Oh, give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion, give me that old time religion, it's good enough for me.
Best Watch is brought to you live with Portions and Recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Keith DeCandido. This is cool. Just know that. Stay tuned. Thank you. from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, music by Peter Schickele, a cut entitled The Space Fleet. This is WBAI, New York City listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Let's see, announcements. Yes, I have an announcement, one announcement about an upcoming show that is very, very cool. It's not next week's Hour of the Wolf, because I'm not quite sure for certain. I have an idea what it will be, but since I haven't had it totally confirmed, I can't say it yet. But you would think that with WBAI being, oh, so political, et cetera, us, no. That on September 11th, and we're about seven blocks from what is so charmingly called Ground Zero, on September 11th, it would just be the usual rhetoric, remembrances, etc., etc., etc. I'm extremely pleased with the most intelligent decision of the program director. That at 11 a.m., I will be on the air on September 11th with Richard Bowes, where he will be reading his short story, There's a Hole in the City, which I think is just one of the most brilliant treatises of what 9/11, and for that matter, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and other tragedies that have struck New York in many years is. So that's, September 11th at 11, and I hope that you tune in for that. The next New York Review of Science Fiction reading isn't until September 13th, and we have one of our favorites, TBD, okay? That's not TBA. TBA has appeared any number of times, and that's, I ain't gonna tell you, that's just to be announced. This is to be determined. I can tell you that Amy Goldschlager will be the guest curator, and that she has some excellent ideas, and as soon as we know what they are, I'll tell you. And October 4th, Susan and Clay Griffith will be reading from their new, it's the Riftwalker, no, not the Chronic Riftwalker, the Riftwalker, which is part of their Vampire Empire series, and the host and co- Not she's not going to be the reader. She will be talking about her obsession of vampire novels. Will be she who created Hour of the Wolf, Margot Adler, who now slums over at National Public Radio. And November 1st will be a tribute to Murray Leinster, or Leinster, I found out is the proper way, with his daughter, Billy Stallings, and Michael Swanwick, and, you know, nobody's like that. I all want you to come and attend the last New York Review of Science Fiction reading, the one that we held last Tuesday, because it was just way cool. And when you get into the Wayback Machine and go there, you will find that Laura Ann Gilman did a fine job, as did Keith DeCandido. And Keith R. A. DeCandido, I was chided. I misspelled Anne in Laura Ann, but Keith R. A. DeCandido is also our guest this morning. And this was actually going to happen some time back.
Yeah, and we were going to do it last month before the reading.
Yeah. Our fundraising drive was extended. That was it. Yeah. That was it.
So we postponed.
We postponed until today. And
here we are.
And here we are. And good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Keith.
So who am us, anyway?
What?
Who am us? That Firesign Theater reference. You kids. Okay.
I never got into Firesign Theater. I don't know why. It just never.
I don't know why. It seemed like something that's right up your alley,
It should be. But believe it or not, I am old enough to have listened to it when I was
And kids, by the so. Way, very important, the Goons turned 60 last week.
Oh, sweet mother.
The Goon Show.
Really?
Was 60 years old last week.
We're old.
I'm not old enough to actually remember. Yeah, you know, I would have been five if it had even been broadcast in the U.S. Yeah. But it was WBAI that carried in the 70s.
Yes.
So,
and I listened to WBAI in the 70s. I grew up listening to this radio station, which frankly explains a lot. And so, yeah, you'd think I would have gotten into that stuff, but I didn't.
Yeah, but Firesign Theater was a big part of WBAI.
I know, but I never got into it. I just
Hugo nominated and all that stuff. Yeah, but yes, there is a "Who am us anyway?"
Yes.
moment in Firesign Theater. But it does come down to, I'm the host of the show. What are you?
I write stuff. I write books.
Oh, one of those
stories and comic books and blog entries and dirty limericks, whatever they'll pay me for, basically. Currently,
is it fair to say that you're a commercial writer, or at least want to be?
Yeah. Well, I've been making a living.
You're both. You do both.
Yeah. I've done a lot of what's referred to as tie-in fiction, which is basically fiction that is based on a property that exists in another medium, usually a TV show or a video game. Something like that. Probably the examples that are most known to the general public are these Star Trek novels and Star Wars novels, which you see all over the bookshelves. Also, books based on games like Dungeons and Dragons and World of Warcraft and things like that. I've actually done a World of Warcraft novel, and I've written well over a dozen Star Trek novels over the years.
That doesn't matter. You've written Doctor Who.
I've also written Doctor Who, yes. In fact,
not that I'm knew a that fan had to come boy.
Yes. No, not a
but
bit
you
of
know
it.
Episode 13.2
and in fact the last time I was on Hour of the Wolf a bunch of years ago
I read a Doctor Who story, yeah, which I really liked.
Thank you. That was in a,
not that I wouldn't have liked it, but I really liked it.
Yeah, thank you. It was, that was part of an anthology called Destination Prague, which was a collection of short stories that took place in Prague.
My mother's hometown.
Ah, there you go.
Well, not born there, but she lived there for enough years, yeah.
And I also edited a Doctor Who short story collection of my own. I didn't have a story in it, but I put it together. It was called The Quality of Leadership, which was tremendous fun to do. And more recently, I've been trying to do some more of my own work that I actually keep the copyright on, which is basically stuff that isn't based on TV shows or video games or anything, but is actually my own creation. The two most recent that came out are Unicorn Precinct and SCPD, The Case of the Claw, both of which are fantastic twists on police procedurals.
Okay, now you have to you have to get into detail.
Well,
on
yes.
This. I mean, just the name Unicorn Precinct is just a grinner. It just makes me go, "Oh, that's cool."
Yes.
You know.
It's actually
what's not to like? Yes. Unicorn, well, precincts maybe, but unicorns and precincts.
Well, that's actually the second book in the series. The first one came out back in 2004. It was called Dragon Precinct. Which it's set in your basic Lord of the Rings, Dungeons and Dragons style fantasy setting. It's a city-state called Cliffsand, which has humans and elves and dwarves and gnomes and halflings and stuff, and there are wizards, and there are, and it's a port town, so it's a port city, so there's docklands, and then there's slums, and there's the middle class district and the upper class district, and they're all divided into precincts. Unicorn Precinct is where the rich people are. Dragon Precinct is the middle class district. Goblin Precinct are the slums. And then Mermaid Precinct are the docks. And there's also Griffin Precinct, which is the castle, which is the center of the city-state where the Lord and Lady live. So I've got five book titles right there.
Yeah.
So
And the titles themselves are suggestive.
Yeah. The main characters are members of the Cliffsend Castle Guard who are tasked with maintaining law and order in the city-state, and they have to solve crimes. Somebody gets murdered. Two members of the castle, detectives from the castle guard, go and try to figure out what happened. And they call in the ME, the magical examiner, who is a wizard on loan from the Brotherhood of Wizards, who casts a spell called a peelback, which shows what happened at the scene.
The Brotherhood of Wizards, the vow.
Yes. And whenever magic is involved in the case, the Brotherhood of Wizards get involved in it, and there are jurisdictional issues and stuff like that. So there's basically, it's taking the setting, the fantasy setting of that type of fantasy setting, and the plot is very much a mystery in the style of a Law and Order episode or
but you're obviously having fun with
it.
I mean you know, this is not grim stuff.
No, not at all,
because one of my biggest complaints about genre stuff today in movies and comics and books and all that is it's also bleeping grim.
No, not grim. Not me.
Not
you. I don't do grim. I mean, yeah. I've done grim every once in a while just for variety, but grim is not.
I mean, you know, Lauren Gilman, who read before right. you.
That was very
good. Gave people a, you each gave the audience a choice and her choice of what to read, and you were giving them different, you know, creatures and universes.
Yeah.
And she said, "Do you want depressing or do you want really depressing?"
And she of course went for really depressing.
Well, of course she did.
Yes.
It was a good story
though. Oh, it's a very good story.
Yeah, but a lot of your stuff tends to be the simplest word is entertaining.
Well, good. I'm glad. That's kind of what I'm going for. And I enjoy writing stuff that's fun to read.
Yeah.
You know, and stuff where I'm particularly a fan of dialogue and you know, interesting conversations between people. It's not a coincidence that two of my favorite screenwriters are Joss Whedon and Aaron Sorkin, both mm-hmm. of whom are masters at dialogue. And I'm also, I have a rather unhealthy obsession with police procedurals. The other original book of mine that's
out.
We
were talking off air about baseball and,
yes.
you know, Moneyball.
Yes.
Aaron Sorkin's screenplay.
Yes.
Isn't it? Or was he fired from it?
I don't remember if he won.
Everybody was fired from that movie yeah, at one point or another.
I don't know if that was him.
I thought he was involved at one point.
Might have been.
Anyway.
I've lost track. I want to see the movie anyway, just because it's a great story.
Yeah.
And, but the other new book of mine out, which is out from right now, it's only available as an ebook. There is a trade edition coming. It's called The Case of the Claw, which is the first book about the SCPD, which is the Super City Police Department. It is also a police procedural. In this case, it is set in a city called Super City, which is filled with costumed superheroes. The genesis of this particular novel series actually comes from reading Spider-Man comics as a kid. Okay, Spider-Man stops a purse snatcher, and he grabs the guy, webs him to a lamppost, hands the woman her purse back, and then goes off because he's late for, you know, a date or has to get medicine to his Aunt May or whatever it is that Spider-Man is late for because he's always late for something. The woman goes off because she's got her purse back, and there's this guy webbed to a lamppost. Now, the cops show up. What are they going to do with this guy? There's no witness, there's no, you know, Spider-Man doesn't make a statement. The woman's already gone off because she's got her purse back. What the hell
can you get
a
DNA on the web, by the way?
No, he wears gloves.
Has anybody ever dealt with that?
Maybe remember, he wears gloves, so there wouldn't be any...
You're not of the biological type of webbing.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, of course, Peter Parker probably isn't in the system. I mean, the DNA only gives you something to compare it to, and I doubt he's in the system. He has no reason to be.
just a thought.
Yeah, I know. But that always bugged me. It's like the cops can't do anything with this guy, and they're going to wind up having to, you know, not they can't arrest. I mean, they could arrest him, but there's nothing to hold him on. You know, and that was something that I always thought about. You know, Superman punches Lex Luthor in the nose and hands him to the police and says, "Take this man to jail." And then
yes,
what?
Sir.
Yeah. But, you know, what happens?
There's no due process here. We've got superheroes.
that's what interested me. So what SCPD is about, it's about the cops. It's about the detectives. It's about the uniforms driving on the street, having to deal with all the different issues that come up when you've got a bunch of guys wearing their underwear on the outside fighting crime and blowing things up. And there are certain things that, you know, the superheroes...
And lots of latex.
And capes. Unless you follow the Incredibles rule. No capes. But,
that's right.
Although some of the heroes... Yeah, basically,
they break those rules, yeah.
Yes. Some of the heroes... They're all heroes that I made up, which is entertaining and difficult in some ways because a lot of the best names are taken. This is something.
Yeah, well, that must get tough actually trying to think up a new superhero.
Yeah, although I've managed so far. I've got the Superior Six and the Terrific Trio, and I've got Spectacular Man and the Bruiser and Suricata and Olerun and Heracles. Gods and animals are very handy to use for this sort of thing. And
I was just thinking, Laura will probably do, you know, like, you know, the meerkat. You know,
yeah. Well, that's what Suricata is, actually.
Suricata, is it?
Yeah. Suricatus is the Latin, the breed name for a meerkat.
I should have known.
Yeah.
I should have known. What is this thing you put somewhere, by the way, about penguins?
What?
What do you have against penguins?
I don't have anything against penguins.
I thought I saw something on Facebook.
No, that was something. Russ Ritchie, who is the owner of Boom Studios. Boom Studios is a comic book company that publishes the Farscape comic book that I have been writing for the past 3 years. And he posted that, and it was a funny meme, and I decided to go ahead and repeat it because I am a sheep. So.
Okay, I am a penguin.
Okay.
Just be it known.
Okay.
Continue.
But, so, yeah.
Laura's a meerkat, and you're a sheep, I'm a penguin.
And you're a penguin. And I'm glad we got that straight, because I'll sleep better tonight knowing this.
And everybody listening to the radio right now is going,
what the hell is he talking about? Anyway, The Case of the Claw is about...
I'm sorry. I'm old enough, and you probably are too, saying that every time you say that, I think, not craw, craw!
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Okay.
Anyway, The Claw, or The Craw, as you see fit, is a spree
Mel
killer.
Mel Brooks has, and Buck Henry have a lot to answer for.
Yes. You know what? The best invention? Saran wrap. Anyway. So the Claw's a spree killer who shows up, who's super powered, and shows up every 2 years, like clockwork, and the cops, once again, are trying to figure out who he is and how to track him down and make him pay for his crimes, because he keeps killing people. And there are other things going on as well, including a battle between the Superior Six and a group called the Brute Squad, where a zap gun that one of the Brute Squad uses gets misplaced and is picked up by a civilian with bad and tragic consequences. And things like that, you know, just stuff they got to deal with. One of the opening scenes has the captain from police headquarters showing up for work and discovering that there is a giant hole in one of the holding cells because the drunk that two of the uniforms picked up last night turned out to have superpowers. They didn't know he had superpowers. He didn't have any ID on him. He wasn't wearing his costume. He was just some drunk. And then when he sobered up, he used his superpowers to blast out of the holding cell. So there are now six unprocessed drunks wandering around because there are other people in the cell with them. And they have to pay to get the wall fixed even though they're already over budget. That's one of the things I like to deal with is my favorite police procedure TV shows and books are ones that actually deal with the day-to-day nonsense that cops have to deal with on a regular basis.
The bureaucracy and everything.
Exactly. Yeah. One of my favorite true crime book is David Simon's Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which was the book that was the basis for the NBC TV show Homicide that ran in the 90s. And also, less directly, the basis of the HBO series The Wire, which is also one of my favorite shows.
Mm-hmm.
Those two shows and that book really show the bureaucracy, the politics, piercing a lot of things that people assume. For one thing, one of my favorite things that I got out of David Simon's book is that cops really don't care about motive. Motive is pretty much not relevant. All they care about is
how. That's for detectives and prosecutors.
Yeah, and even prosecutors. I mean, motive is something that can sometimes help a trial. Yeah. To convince the jury, but that's really it. It's not something that is in any way involved in the actual making of an arrest or making
the crossing
a case.
Of the line. Is yeah,
exactly. All that
the
matters,
line was crossed.
Yeah, all that matters is what and how and who, why. It's not something that really actual cops are particularly interested in. There's before The Wire came on the air. If you ever asked an actual cop what they thought was the most accurate representation of their job on television, they almost always would say Barney Miller.
You know, I was going to say that.
Yes.
I didn't know that, but I was going to say that.
Yes, and because the vast majority of a police officer's job is filling out paperwork and dealing with the crazy people who walked into the precinct.
And it was also one of the best written shows
ever. Oh, yeah, it was brilliant. In fact, a lot of the guys who later would work on Night Court worked on Barney Miller originally.
Yeah.
And great, great show. They've been very slowly releasing it on DVD, and it's been great to. I've been watching it again, and it's just an absolute joy. You know, Abe Vigoda is still alive.
I'm sorry?
Abe Vigoda is still alive.
Yes, he is.
It's amazing. He actually wasn't that.
And Hal Linden just did a big BAI benefit,
yeah,
but hey.
Yeah. But, he just keeps going. He shows up at Friars Club Roasts all the time, you know. That nuts and bolts of the day to day crap that they have to deal with is much more interesting to me. And dealing with people for whom this isn't a calling and this isn't a noble cause, this is their job. You know, and that's Also, a lot of modern police departments are almost obsessed with statistics, and to some extent this has actually made them more effective crime fighters, but it also means that there's a lot of, and you see this in a lot of government work, where statistics become more important even than actually getting work done. I saw this actually quite a bit during 2009 and 2010 when I did some work for the U.S. Census Bureau, where there was also a certain amount of, like, we must get a certain number of, you know, questionnaires done by a certain date, or else actually nothing will happen, but it will look better to our bosses, you know, where you know, you have to get the number of homicides down or the number of violent crimes down from what it was last time and whatnot. And it's just far more obsessed with that than actually doing the job that needs doing. Anyway, this is why I've come back to police procedure so often. Even in a lot of my media tie-in fiction, I've written two Spider-Man novels, which both heavily involved Spider-Man working with the NYPD. I wrote a CSI New York novel, which obviously was a police procedural, it being a CSI New York book, you know. I've worked procedural elements into a bunch of other Marvel Comics-based short stories that I did. For that matter, my first novel based on the TV show Supernatural had an NYPD cop as part of the plot. It's just something I've come back to a lot. And with both the Fantasy Character Precinct series and with SCPD, I'm getting to play around with it a little bit more. I'm working on the next SCPD book right now, and I've also got Goblin Precinct due out next year, and I'm working on the plot for that as well. And those both those books should be out in 2012.
But right now,
Unicorn Precinct and The Case of the Claw or the Craw, you've completely ruined my title for me. Now,
yeah,
by
I'm
the way.
Sorry. Yeah, okay.
They're both available.
We aim for that. Yeah,
thank you. They're both available online to be ordered. If you go to my website, which is decandido.net, that's DECANDIDO. .net, and don't worry, I'll repeat that several thousand times before the show is over. That is a gateway to ordering both those two books, as well as some of my other books, as well as other
and also gets
places.
You your blog and your Facebook
and my
Twitter
and my podcast.
Yeah, and as Laura and I told you last week, you're going to have to start on G+.
At some point, yes.
Yeah, at some point. It's going to be around for a long time.
Once it's out of beta testing.
No, that's 10 years from now. We're talking Google.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't. The beta never ends.
Yes. But yes, I will event. And once I do get on Google Plus,
well, you're there. You're just not using it.
I am.
You have a Gmail account.
I do have a Gmail account. Yes.
You're there. You see, that's one of the insidious things about it. Is when you have a Gmail account, you have a Google profile.
Yeah.
If you have a Google profile, then you're on Google Plus.
Well, gosh.
Just a question of whether or not you're using it.
Right. Well, I will eventually.
It's brilliant and it's insidious.
The Gmail isn't my main email. That's my backup.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm just saying I don't.
It's
use
not
it that
mine
much,
either.
So, yeah.
But
it's a handy backup. You know, in case something goes wrong with my primary email address.
So, what would you rather do? We can chat, we can read.
I'd like to actually read this story because I think it's a cool story. And I should give a little background on the story before I read it, but I would like to read it.
Well, why don't we take a break first?
Okay.
Then you can give the background, then you can give a reading. And normally I wouldn't say that we have to take a background, except I found what I thought was the perfect segue.
Okay.
So we're going to hear it.
Okay.
The legend you are about to hear is true. Only the needle should be changed to protect the record.
This is the countryside. My name is St. George. I'm a knight. Saturday, July 10th, 8:05 p.m. I was working out of the castle on the night watch when a call came in from the chief. A dragon had been devouring maidens. Homicide. My job. Slay him.
Call me, Chief.
Yeah, it's the dragon again, devouring maidens. The king's daughter may be next.
Mm-hmm. You got a lead?
Nothing much to go on. Said you take that .45 automatic into the lab to have him check on it?
Yeah. You were right.
I was right?
Yeah. It was a gun. 8:22 p.m. I talked to one of the maidens who had almost been devoured. Could I talk to you, ma'am?
Who are you?
I'm St. George, ma'am. Homicide, ma'am. I want to ask you a few questions, ma'am. I understand you're almost devoured by the man. Is that right, Dragon?
It was terrible. He breathed fire on me. He banged me already.
How can I be sure of that, ma'am?
Believe me, I got it straight from the dragon's mouth.
11:45 p.m. I rode over the King's Highway. I saw a man. Stopped to talk to him. Pardon me, sir. Could I talk to you for just a minute, sir?
Sure, I don't mind.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a knave.
Didn't they pick you up on a 903 last year for stealing tarts?
Yeah? So what, do you want to make a federal case out of it?
No, sir. We heard there was a dragon operating in this neighborhood. We just want to know if you've seen him.
Sure, I've seen him.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe him for me?
What's to describe? You see one dragon, you seen them all.
Could you try and remember, sir, just for the record? We just want to get the facts, sir.
Well, he was, you know, he had orange polka dots.
Yes, sir.
Purple feet, breathing fire and smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And one big bloodshot eye right in the middle of his forehead, and, like that.
Notice anything unusual about him?
No, he's just a run-the-mill dragon, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, you can go now.
Hey, by the way, how are you going to catch him?
I thought you'd never ask. A dragon net. 3:05 p.m. I was riding back into the courtyard to make my report to the lab. Then it happened. It was a dragon.
Hi, I'm the fire-breathing dragon. You must be St. George, right?
Yes, sir.
I see you got one of them new 45 caliber swords.
That's about the size of it.
You slay me.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
What do you mean?
I'm taking in a 502. You figure it out.
What's the charge?
Devouring maidens out of season.
Out of season? You never pinned that rap on me. Do you hear me, cop?
Yeah, I hear you. I got you in a 412, too.
A 412? What's a 412?
Overacting. Let's go.
On September the 5th, the dragon was tried and convicted. His fire was put out, and his maiden devouring license revoked. Maiden devouring out of season is punishable by a term of not less than 50 or more than 300 years.
Stan Freberg, Dawes Butler, June Foray, Hi Averback. You want to talk the great voices from Cartoon Past?
Oh, yes.
You got them. Stan Freberg, St. George and the Dragon Net.
Yes. What's especially hilarious is one of my absolute favorite reviews of Dragon Precinct, when it came out back in 2004, described the book as Dungeons and Dragnet. Which is a wonderful review, and so, yeah, we started playing that, and I nearly lost it.
Yeah, and but I thought it was appropriate.
Oh, very appropriate.
Let me just say, by the way, it's a WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Need to apologize for the quality of that MP3, but it was acquired on a last-moment thought, so...
Yes. And it's old-time radio. It's supposed to sound scratchy.
No, it isn't. It was old-time. It was 1953, in fact. Yeah. But still, you know, the copy I've got at home is far, far better. It's a far, far better copy than I've ever played before.
It's okay. Anyway, the story...
Oh, it's Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund. Your name is?
Keith R. A. DeCandido.
Okay.
Together, we fight crime. Anyway, I'm part of a group... called the Liars Club, which is a group of a little over a dozen writers. Supposedly, it's supposed to be all writers from the Philadelphia area, and yet they invited me in, and I live in New York. I'm not quite sure I understand this, but there you go. The group includes people from all sorts of different walks of writer life. They're fellow genre writers. Gregory Frost and Jonathan Mayberry are two of the members of the group, as well as people who write, you know, suspense novels, mystery novels, kids' books, what have you. Solomon Jones, Kelly Simmons, Edward Pettit, Don Lafferty, Marie Lamba, Mary Jones, Dennis Tafoya, Keith Strunk, William Lashner, and John McGoran, as well as L.A. Banks, who recently passed away. Leslie was fighting a long illness. In fact, I believe she's been on Hour of the Wolf in the past also.
Mm-hmm.
And she did
2 years of readings for us. Yeah.
Yeah. She got a rare form of adrenal cancer that, they weren't able to do anything.
Age 52.
Yeah. Yeah. And, we had decided, the Liars Club wanted to put together an anthology of stories by each of us. And the anthology is called Liar Liar. And the theme is, you know, as you might guess from the title and from the name of the group.
Fibbing.
Yes, fibbing. Mendacity, as it were. And it's stories all by members of the Liars Club, because we are professional liars. And the story I did for it was...
Don't try this at home.
Yes.
These are professional liars.
Yes, exactly. We get paid for this crap. And my story is called Under the King's Bridge, which is an urban fantasy set in the Bronx, which is where I was born, raised, and still live. And it's called Under the King's Bridge, and I'm going to read it for you now. I gotta tell you, if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it. Now, usually when commuters come out of the Marble Hill Metro North Station in New York City during evening rush hour, they're rushing up the long enclosed staircase to get where they're going, like hamsters in those plastic tubes. On this particular Friday afternoon, though, not so much. As I stood there next to the man who wanted to hire me, the mid-July sun bearing down on us, I watched a whole lot of them shamble up the stairs like the title characters in Dawn of the Dead. Not all of them, mind you. Some were doing the usual mad dash, trying to get out of the airlessness of the covered staircase as quick as possible. They scattered toward the gypsy cabs on 225th Street, or one of the bus stops on Broadway, or the shopping center across the street, or the one train on the corner. Like most New Yorkers, they moved quickly, not really giving a damn about much beyond land-sharking their way to their preferably air-conditioned destination. But all the ones who turned left toward the Marble Hill neighborhood that the station serviced were just shuffling. They barely picked their feet up. You expect that sort of thing to an extent when it's pushing 90 degrees, but not like this. I turned to look at my companion, who regarded me with anxiety. See what I mean, Mr. Gold? It's like you said, like they all started mainlining Prozac or something. Yeah, I nodded. Last time I saw expressions that vacant, it was in a high school. All right, I guess I'll take the case. I probably should back it up a bit. My new client had called me and made an appointment to see me in my office, identifying himself as Isaiah Daly. He was a tall African-American gentleman arriving for the appointment wearing a New York Yankees t-shirt, khaki shorts, and moccasins. I let him in the front door, which had a nice black engraved nameplate that read, Bram Gold, Courser. First thing he asked when he walked in was, "So, Mr. Gold, I have to ask, what is a courser, exactly?" I sighed. I always got this when people outside the game hired me. "It's a hunting term, actually, and hunting is pretty much what we do. Have a seat, and please, call me Bram." Daly was fidgeting as he sat down in my guest chair. "Why not just call yourselves hunters?" I planted myself on the other side of the desk, the chair squeaking as my butt hit the cushion. "We used to be called that. Well, actually, we used to be called Slayers, but then Buffy the Vampire Slayer got popular in the 90s, and everybody thought we were just role-playing or something. So we switched to Hunters. And then Supernatural got popular, and we finally just went with Coursers. We figured no Hollywood writer is going to know what that is." "I'm sorry, Mr. Gold, but nobody else is going to know either." I grinned. "Good point. And like I said, call me Bram. Anyhow, I'm assuming you didn't make the appointment with me to ask about my job title?" "No, I..." He hesitated and fidgeted some more, then looked around at the blank gray walls and the big window that had a mostly uninteresting view of the Major Deacon Expressway. Part of why I chose the location on West 230th Street and Broadway in the Northwest Bronx was that it was easy to get to. Right off the Deacon, also the one train, about seven different city bus lines, and the aforementioned Marble Hill Metro North Station. "This place is kind of dingy," I winced. Besides the fact that he was stalling some more, he was also hitting a sore point. "I don't use this office all that much, truth be told. I mean, I got it as a mail drop and a place to meet with clients, but all the mail I get is junk. And to be honest, Mr. Daly, you're the first person in 6 months who wanted to see me here. Most of my clients are either regular customers or they don't want to get together in public." I didn't mention that I cleaned the place for the first time in 6 months for the 2 hours before I got here. Place didn't so much have dust bunnies as dust rhinos. And man, was I glad that the air conditioner in the window still worked. "So what did you..." Yeah, sorry, Mr. Gold, I just..." Another hesitation. "It's not Mr. Daly, it's Reverend Daly. I'm one of the pastors at St. Stephen's." I nodded. St. Stephen's United Methodist Church was one of the oldest churches in the area, and one of the most popular. It had been at that location since the end of the 19th century. "For the last week or so, Mr. Gold, lots of folks have been acting... weird." Deciding not to make a third offer to drop the formality already, I folded my hands together and sat them on my desk. "Define weird, please, Reverend Daly." "Just kind of lifeless. Like they're zombies, almost." "Actual zombies, or what everyone thinks zombies are like?" Daly frowned. "I'm sorry?" I kept forgetting that not everyone was in the game. Actual zombies are corpses that are animated by a spell, and the person doing the animating has to maintain it, usually from pretty close proximity. They don't actually shamble across the terrain muttering, "Brains." Well, nobody's casting a spell on them, if that's what you mean. People can do that? Way more than you'd believe. Okay. He seemed nonplussed, not surprisingly. Lots of religious types were in the game. My own knowledge of it came from my rabbi, who's also my aunt. But Methodists tended to be a little too literal-minded to buy into it. They're all kind of listless, I guess. Just, like you said, shambling? They wander down to the Metro North station or the one train or whatever, and then they go to work, and then they wander home at the end of the day. The worst thing, though, is that nobody's been showing up for services. I scratch my chin. Nobody? The Reverend shook his head. Been empty since Sunday. I seriously doubted that St. Stephen's had ever had even a weekday service with no attendance in the century plus since they opened. Hell, I doubt they ever got below a dozen. I assume you went through the usual channels? Oh, yeah. Called the local precinct. They said people not going to church wasn't a crime, with which I respectfully disagreed. Called Con Ed in case it was, I don't know, a gas leak or something. They didn't find anything either. Points for thoroughness. So you called me? One of the detectives at the 50th Precinct sent me to you. I smiled. Detective Al Toscano wasn't in the game, but he knew about it, and he was more than happy to keep the rest of the NYPD as far away from it as possible. All right, before I take the case, I'd like to see what's going on for myself, see if it really is in my line. I don't want to take your money and then discover it's, I don't know, everyone doped up on bad anti-anxiety meds or something. Daly seemed taken aback by that. Really? Thanks. I mean, I brought a checkbook. I figured you'd... Waving him off, I said, it's all right. Last thing I wanted to do was gouge a church. Tough enough to hire someone to fix something that you may not even really believe exists, but to take all their money before you even start, that's not how I like to do business. Why don't you come meet me at the Marble Hill Metro North Station when the 605 train comes in? Daly asked. Back at the Metro North Station, the Reverend asked me if he wanted to go back to my office. Twice in 1 year? I laughed. No thanks. I quickly quoted him my rates, and he wrote me a check for the first day's work. Sweat dripped off his forehead onto the lower left-hand corner of the check, smudging the memo section. All he'd written there was PI. Strictly speaking, I wasn't actually a private investigator, but it wasn't worth trying to explain that. I was an expert in my field, and I was a licensed courser, which was all that mattered in this instance. Besides, that was probably an easier sell to the church's bookkeeper. I take it this is something in your line of work? It's a supernatural creature, yeah. Sometimes it just didn't pay to beat around the bush. If I'm right, and I'm pretty sure I am right, this is a lamprey. Daly frowned. Isn't that a kind of fish? I nodded. Yeah, it's also a fish, but that's the name somebody gave to an animal that sucks energy out of people. In fact, you know the whole thing from Dracula about how vampires can't cross running water? Yeah. Total horseshit, but lampreys, who are kind of like energy vampires, are the ones who can't do that. Stoker mixed them all up. Holding up both hands and shuddering a bit, Daly asked, hang on, vampires are real too? Yeah, but don't worry, they're total wusses. Daly frowned. What, Stoker's wrong, but Stephanie Meyer's right? Not hardly. This time I shuddered. No, I mean, they're long-lived and they heal most any wound, but they're also weak, sickly, pale people who don't like sunlight very much. Stoker got most of it wrong, and he took the avoids running water thing from lampreys, is all I'm saying. Damn. Daly let out a very long breath. You're seriously messing with what I know of God's world, Mr. Gold. You came to me, Reverend. That I did. He shook his head. Just figure it out, please. I hate preaching to an empty room. He headed in the general direction of St. Stephen's while I took out my smartphone. Miriam Zarelli was the wardeen of the Bronx. She was in charge of all magical activity on the peninsula. That meant she was one of those regular clients I mentioned, and also a handy resource. Of course, I got her voicemail when I called. Hey, Mimi, could you do me a favor and see if there's any mention in the diaries of a lamprey in Marble Hill? I spent the next hour following around the various shamblers who came out of Metro North. The first clue that something was up was the simple fact that a tall, dark, and semi-handsome Jewish guy followed them home and they didn't notice. Well, most of them didn't. This one lady who lived on the corner of Adrian and 225th was giving me a nasty look. And she was walking normally, too. And so was a little kid who was riding a tricycle over on Terrace View Avenue. Both those were on the outskirts of Marble Hill. The neighborhood was pretty tiny as it was. In fact, it was originally part of Manhattan. In the late 19th century, they cut through the land at the south end of Marble Hill so that the Harlem River would run straight across, thus making shipping a whole hell of a lot easier. At first, that made Marble Hill an island, but then around World War I, they filled in the north side, and it was physically connected to the Bronx. That also eliminated the object for which the Kingsbridge neighborhood was named, as you now went from there to Marble Hill by traversing a street rather than the King's Bridge over the river. But because it used to be a peninsula and then an island, it was pretty well enclosed, so it didn't take long to check the whole neighborhood. The southern and western edges, which included St. Stephen's, looked unaffected. Next step was to figure out what the epicenter of the affected area was. Normally I'd need a map, but Marble Hill was only about 1,000 feet by 800 feet or so, so all of it wasn't hit with this potential lamprey. Didn't take long to figure out that the middle was on 227th Street. What got my attention was the house that had a for sale sign on the front door, along with a local phone number and a website URL. Nobody was home when I went up to the stoop and rang the bell, but I saw plenty of furniture inside. I pulled my smartphone back out of my pocket and checked the website. It belonged to Brauch Realty, a place that specialized in houses in Riverdale, Kingsbridge, Marble Hill, and Inwood. I found the listing for this house, looked it over, and then dialed their number.
Brauch Realty, this is Tara,
came a perky voice on the other end. Hi, my name's Abe Goldblum, and I wanted to inquire about the house on West 227th Street in Marble Hill. Any chance of a viewing this weekend?
Oh, sure, we'd be happy to,
Tara sounded positively overjoyed.
Oh, we can't do it tomorrow afternoon, that's when the movers are coming, but any time in the evening or Sunday will work.
The movers coming meant the current owners might be present. Even if they weren't, I wanted to get a look at it before they took stuff away, or failing that, during. Actually, Saturday afternoon is the only time I can do it. I'm going out of town for a week tomorrow night. Eh, too bad, the place was perfect for what I'm looking for. Oh well.
Well, wait, Mr. Goldblum.
Tara sounded a bit panicky, fearing the potential sale slipping through her fingers.
Let's see what we can arrange. Tell you what, would you mind looking at the house while people are moving things?
Why should I mind? I grinned. Say noon?
Perfect.
We exchanged information, and then I disconnected. Tara was no doubt now checking my credit history, which was why I had to use my real name. For coarser business, I call myself Bram Gold, because, let's face it, that's the name of a guy who can get stuff done. I mean, if you need someone to corral a werewolf or wrangle a unicorn or put down a Nixie, you're not going to hire some schmuck named Abe Goldblum, am I right? I headed down to Marble Hill to 228th, and then down 228th to Broadway, where I would catch the bus that would take me home. Just as I got to the bus stop, Miriam called me back. I hit talk on my phone and said, Joe's Pizza, Joe's not here. You know, Bram, that joke wasn't funny the first 1,000 times. When has that ever stopped me? I asked with a chuckle.
I live in hope.
Miriam let out a long-suffering sigh. We'd been friends since we were kids, when her dad was the war dean and I was the nephew of her dad's best friend, my aforementioned aunt-slash-rabbi.
I have good news and bad news. I've checked as far back as I can, and there haven't been any lampreys in Marble Hill or anywhere else in the domain since 1914.
That's a very specific date, Mimi.
Noticed that, did you?
That's why they pay me the small bucks.
Hey, come on, I pay you the same as any courser. I don't even ask for a friend discount.
You're all heart. Why the exact date?
Because prior to that, Marble Hill was an island that was still considered part of Manhattan.
I saw where this was going. Wardeen's domains were geographic, not political. Miriam's bailiwick covered not just the Bronx, but most of Westchester County to the north and bits of western Connecticut. Manhattan, though, had its own separate one.
So, Miriam concluded, if you want to know anything prior to the First World War, you gotta talk to Van Owen.
I let out a sigh that was even longer in its suffering than the one Miriam had hit me with.
I hated dealing with Damien Van Owen.
He'd been the War Dean of Manhattan since roughly the Mesozoic. He also had had trouble with the Digital Revolution. Miriam was able to get back to me quickly because she had all the Bronx War Dean's diaries digitized and searchable. A few keystrokes, she had the answer to my question. But Van Owen's records were still on paper and sorted in his apartment on Central Park West in nothing like a meaningful fashion.
I don't want to talk to Van Owen. He hates me.
He hates me, too. That isn't especially comforting. Suck it up, boy chick. I could hear her grin. I winced. Mimi, Booby, please, don't bring the Yiddish. Then don't call me Mimi. And she hung up. The bus arrived and I hopped on, dropping my MetroCard into the slot. As the bus tootled down Broadway, I dialed Van Owen's number. He answered on the first ring, which made me at once happy and chagrined. The former, because it had moved things along, the latter because I'd have to actually talk to the old bastard instead of just trading voicemails.
What do you want, Gold?
Charming as ever. I need you to check back and see if there were any lampreys on Marble Hill before World War I.
Don't need to check. Last lamprey sighting in my domain was on Marble Hill in November 1913. Surprised you didn't remember, actually, given that one of yours was involved.
I frowned. I'm sorry?
Elena Hauk.
Oi.
Yeah, oi is one way of putting it, yes. Not exactly the finest hour in coarser history, but she had no business being granted a license in the first place.
The last thing in the universe I wanted to do was get into an argument with Van Owen.
Fine, whatever. And 1913 makes sense. It's in the window. Excuse me? I took some minor pleasure in the high and mighty Damien Van Owen not understanding what I was talking about. The 16-year window between 1898 and 1914 when Marble Hill was an island. Since the Lampreys can't cross running water, best plan is to trap them on an island. Yes, yes, Van Owen interrupted testily. I'm familiar with the weaknesses of Lampreys. If there isn't anything else, I have actual work to do. Knowing this stuff is your work. For my domain, yes. Marble Hill regrettably now falls under the inferior supervision of your friend Miss Zarelli. So speak to her. Before I could point out that I did speak to her and needed to speak to him to cover the pre-1914 stuff, he hung up on me. That was when I really started giving it to him. Okay, not really, but I thought about it. The only thing that stopped me was that I was on a bus full of people. Not that New York bus riders would think twice about a guy yelling obscenities into a smartphone. I got off at my stop and walked home. Once I got inside, I called Miriam back. This time she answered on the first ring. Don't tell me Van Owen got back to you already. Yep. I filled her in on what her Manhattan counterpart told me. Crap, I should have remembered that. That woman. She sighed. There wasn't another female courser for half a century because of her. I gotta tell you, I know she was the first female courser and the last one until the 60s, but I don't know the specifics. It was a big scandal when she was chosen to be an apprentice. Her tutor was Secundo Tartarone, who was one of the best there ever was. Most of the other coursers and the local war deans thought he was insane for taking her on, and then she got him killed. After that, her first job was to round up a lamprey, and after that she retired, saying she couldn't handle it. Every single woman who tried to be a courser for years was slapped down because Elena Hauck was proof that women didn't have the fortitude. Well, that's a load of crap. Hey, there's a reason why the first black baseball player was also great. If Jackie Robinson snuck up the place, it would have been decades before another black player cracked the major leagues. Why do you think it took 2.5 decades for another viable female candidate in a presidential election after Geraldine Ferraro? If you're going to be a pioneer, you have to not suck at your job. And Elena Hauck was a wretchedly awful courser. I let out a long breath. Miriam obviously felt pretty strongly about this. Not that I blamed her. She was the first of the Bronx Wardens to be female since the first one was assigned back in the 18th century. Of course, that position was hereditary, so gender didn't really enter into how you got the position. She told me she'd email the Bronx Wardens' diary entries that mentioned Hauck, as well as the current password for the database, and by the time I fired my laptop up, it was waiting for me. I spent the next half hour reading over what the early 20th century Bronx Warden, a crotchety bastard named Gildo Zarelli, Miriam's great-grandfather, had to say about Hauck. None of it good. She'd started her apprenticeship to Tartarone in June 1912, and a year later she was licensed. Mr. Tartarone has explained that the woman he has been seen with is his apprentice, a Miss Elena Hauck. He is not the first to accept an application from a woman, and I dare say that Miss Hauck will fail as all the others did before her. The calling of Slayer is not one for the fairer sex. Miss Hauck's hysterical carelessness has resulted in the untimely demise of Mr. Tartarone during their pitched combat against a water elemental, though the elemental was, at least, cast out. Was called upon by Miss Hauck with an offer of services as a Slayer. I provided her with tea, as is civil, but politely refused, as her abilities are not adequate to the task. Although Miss Hauck displayed uncharacteristic cleverness in luring the Lamprey to Marble Hill Island, thus effectively trapping it before putting the creature to death, it was with a profound sense of relief that I learned of her retirement from the ranks of the Slayers. Tartarone's death was in August 1913, not long after Hauck was licensed. She trapped the Lamprey on Marble Hill in November 1913, like Van Owen said, and she retired right after that. Meanwhile, I was wondering where this new Lamprey came from. I switched over to the password-protected online database that Miriam maintained. The password was only given out at Miriam's discretion, and it changed every hour on the hour, and also changed when someone used it, so the same password never worked twice. Each password was a random collection of capital and lowercase letters, numbers, and symbols. Sadly, there wasn't much on Lampreys beyond what I already knew. They sucked energy, and they had about a billion teeth, so anytime you tried to wrangle them, they'd bite the living hell out of you. In particular, nobody had recorded anything about their life cycles, methods of reproduction, or anything else useful, beyond the fact that they usually lived for about a century, and their gray skin turned white when they were about to die. They weren't all that common around here anyhow. They were mostly found in Europe. In fact, the one Hauck dealt with was assumed to have come over as an egg on one of the many immigrant-bearing boats that hit New York Harbor on either side in 1900. Weirdly, given their aversion to running water, they tended toward damp, dark places. They were sensitive to sunlight, something else they shared with the vamps, more so when hungry for life energy. They'd suck that out of people, sometimes to the point of death.
but not always, interestingly enough. I couldn't do much until the next day, so I checked Brock Realty's website again, finding a picture of Tara O'Neill. I knew to look for a blue-eyed blonde with long curly hair tomorrow. The next day, I put on a button-down shirt from Brooks Brothers and a nice pair of khakis. I wanted to look like I had money to spend, but I didn't want to die in the heat, and trundled back down to Marble Hill. Since the appointment was for noon, I made sure to get there at 11:30. When I arrived, two harried-looking, dark-haired people, one male, one female, very obviously related as they had the same eyes, nose, and cheekbones, were standing near the stoop. The woman was yelling at three burly Latino guys who were gingerly carrying a couch down the stoop while the man was futzing with a smartphone. "Why are you guys moving so slow? Hello? Jesus Christ, you even listening to me?" Without even looking up from his phone, her brother said, "Nobody ever does, sis." "Excuse me," I said tentatively. "My name's Abe Goldblum. I was supposed to look at the house." "Jesus Christ," the woman said. "That stupid bitch. We told her not to show nobody the house this afternoon." I smiled sheepishly. "Actually, that's my fault. I'm headed out of town tonight, and I honestly don't give a hoot if the movers are here. So I asked if I could come this afternoon. Just want to see what the place looks like." The woman put her hands on her hips. "It ain't convenient, all right?" Finally, looking up from his phone, the man said, "Ignore my sister. Seriously, just ignore her. Totally ignore her. You'll live longer." He put the phone in the pocket of his jeans. He was wearing a tight t-shirt and tight jeans, showing off a too-sculpted physique that looked like it was the result of daily gym workouts. Offering his hand, he said, "I'm Val DeLucci. This is my sister, Sam." I accepted the handshake, shaking harder than he probably expected. I had a decent physique, too, but I preferred to hide that particular light under a bushel, especially since I got it wrangling unicorns and getting beaten up by trolls. "Whoa, that's quite a grip you got there, Mr. Goldblum." "Thanks. So why are you guys selling such a nice place?" Sam answered before Val could speak. "It ain't ours. Belonged to our grandpa. Crazy old bastard. Never talked to nobody, wouldn't answer the phone, wouldn't do nothing." "He had Alzheimer's," Val added. "No, he didn't. Doctors checked him out, remember? Said he didn't have none of the signs. He was just, I don't know, listless or something." "The doctor was full of it. He was lying. If it was Alzheimer's, he couldn't run more expensive tests, the bastard." I frowned, focusing on the use of the past tense. "So he died?" "Val nodded. Yeah, last week. He was 95. A car pulled up on 227th and double parked. Tara had cut her hair since last she had had her picture taken for the realtor's website and straightened it into an above-the-neck bob that probably was more comfortable in the heat. She wore a white blouse and a black miniskirt that showed off a pair of legs that went all the way to the floor. If I had legs like that and I was in the business of selling things, I'd wear miniskirts too.
"Oh, Mr. Goldblum, you're early. Val, Sam, I'm so sorry. I was hoping to get here early to warn you."
"It's fine," Val said. "No, it ain't!" Sam was livid. "Look, we don't want nobody seeing all of Grandpa's crap, all right?" I waved my hand back and forth. "It's fine. You should see all the garbage my old man collected. When Mom and I sold their old place, it was a nightmare." Actually, Mom and Dad had almost nothing in the house, and after they were killed by a golem, the event that led to my current calling, it took me all of an hour to clean out the place. Tara took me inside, walking past the death glare of Sam and the eye-rolling of Val. It was a very nice Victorian, four bedrooms, huge living room, nice dining room, and at the moment a ton of boxes and smelly old furniture. After looking around downstairs and upstairs and making all the right noises, including complaining about the kitchen, which looked like it hadn't been remodeled since Eisenhower was president, I asked, "Can I see the basement?"
"I don't think it's finished," Tara said weakly. "And there was a lot of stuff stored down there, so you really won't get much of a sense of it until the movers are..."
"It's fine. I want to see it. I like basements, and I'll probably want to finish it and make it a workroom." It took another 30 seconds of cajoling, but Tara finally remembered that the customer was always right, and she led me to the dark, creaky wooden staircase near the kitchen that led into the bowels of the house. Mildew and mustiness assaulted my nostrils as I went down the stairs, Tara's high heels clacking behind me. The house was built into the hill, so the front of the basement was at street level. That end was mostly boxes, some in pretty wretched shape. Two things caught my eye, only one of which I was in a position to do something about now. The first, which I left alone, was the trapdoor built into the floor. I did not want to open that while half a dozen civilians were wandering around. The other, though, was a box that had a label that looked like it was typed with a manual typewriter. It was faded, but I could make out the words, "Elena Hauk." At this particular thickening of the plot, I turned to Tara.
"Does that say Elena Hauk?"
She bent over and peered at it.
"I think so. Why?"
"I need to talk to Val and Sam." I ran upstairs, a confused Tara following soon after.
Sam was bitching at the movers for moving so slowly, though I had a feeling they weren't doing so on purpose if what I thought was under that trapdoor was under it. I looked at Val. I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. DeLucci, but there's a box downstairs that has a name on it. Yeah, our great-grandmother's shit. Excuse my language. She was Elena DeLucci after she married our great-granddad, obviously, but Hauk was her maiden name. Grandpa never let us touch her stuff, and it's all covered in mildew. Honestly, we're just gonna throw it out. It's useless trash. Do you mind if I take a look in the box? See, I'm kind of a genealogy buff, and there's this one relative we've never been able to find out anything about. Her name's Elena Hauk, and she lived somewhere in the Bronx after the First World War. But that's it. I'd love to see if it's her. Val looked over at his sister, who was still haranguing the movers, now taking a coffee break. If you want, yeah, go ahead, I guess. Just don't breathe through your nose. I grinned, grateful for kids who don't care about the past. Thanks! Dashing back down the creaky stairs, I easily ripped open the decades-old paper tape that weakly held the box shut. Opening it, my nose was, as expected, assaulted by mold and mildew. Lots of yellowed paper, jewelry, mothballed clothes, and weapons! There was what was once a very nice crossbow, but with rusted metal and warped wood. A few daggers, also rusted, and a rapier that had rust and pits in the metal. This was obviously where Elena Hauk had packed away her life as what was then called a slayer, before marrying some guy named DeLucci and becoming a wife and mother like everyone told her she was supposed to. But that still left the question of the lamprey. I found a leather-bound notebook that had a rusted lock on it. Even if there had been a key in evidence, it probably wouldn't have worked. Val came down the stairs. Christ, what is all that? It's some rusted old stuff. I tried to sound dismissive. Mind if I borrow this? I know someone who might be able to get this lock off. That someone was going to be one of the spellcasters I knew, but he didn't need to be told that part. Sure, Val shrugged. Like I said, we were just going to throw it out. Bunch of old crap, you know? Thanks. I'll drop it off today, and it should be open by the time I get back from my trip. I made a show of looking at some more of the house, then took my leave. Tara wished me a safe flight, as did Val. Sam made me very grateful for the lack of laser vision in the real world, since I'd have been zapped right there. As soon as I was out of sight of the house, I whipped out my phone. I knew a mess of spellcasters who could do this, but the only ones who weren't pissed at me, on vacation, or already on a job they couldn't come away from, were Teitelbaum, who wouldn't be working on a Saturday afternoon, and Velez. I sighed. I hated having to call Velez. By the time the bus brought me back up to my townhouse, I had spoken to Velez, and he said he was on his way. I also called Miriam and told her about my find. When I got home, I changed into a t-shirt and denim shorts and sat down at the computer. I answered a few emails until the doorbell rang and I buzzed Velez in. I lived in the three-bedroom flat on the second floor of the three-apartment townhouse that I owned, with my cousin renting out the one-bedroom space on the first floor and the top floor used for storage and a home office. Jose Velez slowly ambled up the stairs, huffing and puffing as he hauled his 350 pounds against gravity. When I showed him the locked diary and explained that I needed him to crack it open, he peered at me over his glasses like he was an angry teacher or something. There's a locksmith that's like 2 blocks from here, yo. The hell you haul my fat ass up here for? This diary belonged to Elena Hauk. Who's that, your ex-girlfriend or something? I sighed. History's just a feature on your web browser, isn't it? Kiss my entire ass, gold. Hauk was the first female courser. Whoop-dee-doo, can we do this? I got places to be. I stared at him. If you got places to be, why'd you take my call? Velez pointedly didn't answer, instead digging into his shoulder bag. He started setting out what he'd need. A pestle, bottle of herbs, New York Yankees Zippo, a stick, and 3 different bottles of water. He put 2 of the latter back after staring at the labels. What, they're not all holy water? I asked snidely. He regarded me with his usual annoyance. Yeah, like that crap works. Nah, for this I needed the swamp water to soak the poplar root in. I chuckled. Holy water was no different from any other kind of water, something that really disappointed people who tried splashing it onto vampires. That only did damage if the vamp was wearing a silk shirt. As for the poplar root, even I knew that that was a tap root, one which would go through concrete to find water. It was perfect for breaking through something. Velez dumped some herbs into the stick into the pestle, and then poured in the swamp water, and then lit the Zippo and ran the flame under the pestle. I sniffed. That mint? Nodding, Vela started murmuring something I couldn't make out. Spells were out of my league. Or in a different league, really. I left that to the specialists like Velez. After a few seconds, I heard a clicking sound, and the diary fell open. There you go. So I gotta ask, what's the magical power of mint? Makes your iced tea taste better, Velez said with a grin. I just add that up in there so it don't stink. Swamp water's nasty, yo. I wrote Velez a check for his services, but he didn't leave. You think I'm opening this and ain't finding out what's on the inside?
I rolled my eyes. Fine, whatever. I opened the diary up. The first page I turned to had a detailed description of Hauk taking down a werewolf. Tartarone incapacitated from wine, as usual, and I was once again forced to hunt for him. Werewolf proved susceptible to steel bullets as much as silver ones, since Tartarone too taken with drink to provide location of ladder. That wasn't the part that blew me away. It was the date. The 14th day of April, the year of our Lord, 1910. A good 3 years before her official apprenticeship started. I flipped through more pages, which told of other exploits that most people probably thought were committed by Tartarone, but were in fact thanks to Elena Hauk. Tartarone, in one of his more lucid moments, has decided that I must be officially apprenticed. It is the only way to appease Zarelli, who grows suspicious of my presence. If I am to continue to act during Tartarone's ever-increasing bouts of intoxication, I must become a proper slayer. Damn! Velez muttered as he read over my shoulder. People really talk like that? Shrugging, I said, different time. I kept flipping pages. Then I walked out the door while dialing Miriam. Velez lumbered down the stairs behind me. Where the hell are you going? You know any spells that can stop a lamprey? Can imprison one for 3 days, but only if you got some more mint, because that one stinks bad. We'll have to live with it. Where'd you park? Excuse me? You want to follow along? I said as I went out onto the sidewalk. You can drive me down to 227th between Van Corlear and Adrian. All right. Velez led me to his bright red 3000 GT. I hopped into the passenger seat while he squeezed his massive frame into the tiny driver's seat. I never understood why a guy the size of Mount Rushmore owned an automobile that was only slightly bigger than a matchbox car. Miriam finally answered. What is it, Brom? You're not going to believe this. I filled her in on what I'd read about Elena Hauk while Velez blazed down Johnson Avenue. The kicker is that she didn't get Tartarone killed. She'd been carrying his drunk ass for years. When he did get killed, it was because he was so toasted he was belligerent and forced her to take him with her when she went after the water elemental. That's not possible, Bram. Secundo Tartarone was one of the finest coursers ever. No, Elena Hauk was, in pretending it was Tartarone, while the finest courser ever drank himself into an early grave. And that's not the kicker. Jesus, Velez, that's a red light! You're in a car with Velez? Miriam sounded understandably concerned. He got the locked diary open, and besides, I needed to get back down the house faster than the bus will take me. See, the lamprey she claimed to put down, she didn't. It was an infant, and Elena couldn't bring herself to kill it. She left a lamprey alive? I nodded, even though she couldn't see that over the phone. She couldn't kill a baby animal that was totally defenseless. Hadn't even developed any teeth yet. So she took it in. She hadn't been getting much work as a courser anyhow, since everyone assumed she was the incompetent who got the great Secundo Tartarone killed. So what, she kept the lamprey as a pet? Sorta. Velez was driving down Kingsbridge Avenue to where the King's Bridge used to be. Now it was just Marble Hill Avenue. It lived in the basement under a trapdoor, and she and her family kept feeding it enough life energy to survive, but not to hurt anyone. And that was all well and good, but her son just died last week at the ripe old age of 95, and the rest of the family moved it out. Everyone thought the old man had Alzheimer's, but he didn't test for it. It was the lamprey? Uh-huh. This place, with the for sale sign, I said to Velez as he drove down 227th. Yeah, the lamprey just took from him until he started losing it. Now it's just sucking energy wherever it can, now that its principal food source is dead. I gotta go, Mimi. I'll keep you posted. You'd better. Velez parked behind the moving truck. Sam DeLucci was now chatting amiably with her brother, and the movers were doing their work at a much brisker pace. Sam's amiability dropped as soon as she saw me, of course. The hell are you doing back here? I thought you were flying somewhere or something. I ignored her and talked to Val. I need to get back into the basement now. I don't understand. Val looked back and forth to me and Velez. Who's this guy? Just call me the exterminator, Velez said with an unpleasant smile. Not helping, I muttered. Look, there may be something bad down there. Trust me, you want to sell this place? Let me see what's down there and let my friend the exterminator take care of it. Sam moved to stand in front of the stoop while Val dithered. No way. I don't know who you think you are, but you already seen this place, and I ain't even sure you're a real buyer. I started to tell my cover story, and then stopped. This whole thing started because Elena Hauk couldn't tell the truth about her own abilities as a courser, or that her mentor was a drunk, and I've been compounding it by lying to get into this house. Enough already. There's a creature who's been feeding on people in this neighborhood for the past week. Your grandfather inherited it from your great-grandmother, who kept it as a pet down in the basement. Now, though, I'm worried about it. What is it? Val asked. The fuck? What the hell are you talking about? Sam interrupted. Velez hauled out his shoulder bag. Hell with this. He pulled out some ash and threw it in Sam's face. She coughed and then stopped moving completely.
Val panicked. What'd you do to her? She'll be fine in about an hour, Vela said. Come on, Gold, let's do this. I stared at Sam's still form for a second before following Velez up the stairs. Val was still agog and didn't acknowledge our entry into the house. As I led the way down the creaky stairs, I asked, will she really be okay in an hour? Velez shrugged. She'll have a bitch of a migraine, and ain't no detergent in the world gonna get that stuff out of her clothes, but yeah, she'll be alright. Unless she's allergic to shellfish. Then she'll probably get a rash. Before I could respond to that, the smell hit me. You know what a dead skunk smells like? This odor made me nostalgic for that. I went straight for the trap door I'd seen before. Opening it, the smell got much worse. Putting his hand over his nose and mouth, Vela said, ain't enough mint in the world! Looking down into a good-sized crawl space, I saw the long, snake-like form and giant, teeth-filled mouth of a lamprey. It was surrounded by several well-worn cushions, a pipe that dripped water, lampreys took in moisture through the skin, so that was the equivalent of a water bowl for it, and a few other decorations that made it clear that this wasn't just a lair for the lamprey. This was the home of a beloved pet. The lamprey was also white, not gray. As soon as I opened the trap door, it raised its head toward me and bared its teeth. I started to feel listless. It was sucking the energy right out of me. Fatigue started to smother me like a blanket, and I couldn't even work up the energy to care. Then it looked at Velez, who was smiling. Bring it on, bitch! My own energy level started to improve. The lamprey was obviously focused on Velez. After a second, it let out a high-pitched wail and then collapsed in the crawl space, unmoving. Peering into it, Velez nodded. That is one dead lamprey. What'd you do? I asked. Nothing. Just let it chow down. Thing was whiter than you, so I knew it was too old to handle my mojo. Right. Spellcasters had considerably more life energy than the average person, and the lamprey probably gorged on Velez. I should have been glad. I'd been hired to get rid of a lamprey, and now it was gone. Okay, I didn't actually do anything, Velez did, but still, mission accomplished. The lamprey wouldn't be sucking the energy out of people in Marble Hill. Between us, Velez and I would dispose of the corpse. Then I'd call Reverend Daly and tell him that he'd probably start getting folks back in St. Stephen's before too long. But I still felt like crap. Elena Halk looked past what everyone was saying and saw a helpless creature. The same people who told her she had to kill it were the ones who told her she was the lousiest courser around. So she showed a compassion instead, and it lived a long and happy life. But when her son died, nobody knew about it. Another lie, even though it was of omission. So, want me to incinerate this puppy? Velez asked. No. Say what? I said no, I snapped. Let's give this guy a burial. Least he deserves. Least Elena deserves. Velez shrugged. Whatever, yo. Sold just so long as I get paid. Yeah. What he just did was above and beyond opening a lock, so he'd demand more money. Probably eat up most of my fee from Reverend Daly, but maybe I could justify hiring him as one of the expenses. I gently pulled the corpse out of the crawl space. The lamprey would get a proper burial. And Elena Hauk would get a proper legacy. Damn it.
Back to back, belly to belly, well I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at least some bitch and Marina Heady caught us. Back to back, belly to belly, well I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at least some bitch and Marina.
No lampreys were harmed in the broadcasting of this radio show.
Zombie jamboree took place in Long Island Cemetery. Zombies from all parts of the island.
Where?
Some of them are great Calypsonians. Hey, since the season was carnival, they got together in Bacchanal. What you doing?
Back to back, belly to belly. Well, I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at the zombie jamboree. Back to back, belly to belly, well I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at the zombie jamboree.
One female zombie wouldn't behave, she say she want me for a slave. In the one hand she's holding a quart of wine, in the other she's pointing that she'll be mine. Well believe me folks, yes I had to run.
Why?
The husband of a zombie ain't no fun.
No, not
I
it.
Says, oh no, my turtle dove, that old bag of bones I cannot hug. But what you doing?
Back to back, belly to belly, well I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at the zombie jamboree.
Oh, what a good game.
Back to back, belly to belly, well I don't give a damn, cause I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly, at the zombie jamboree.
Right then and there she raised her feet. I'm a-going to catch you now, my sweet. I'm gonna make you call me Sweetie Pie. I says, oh no, get back, you lie. I mean, the lion, but
what you will see.
What?
After you kiss this dead zombie.
Yeah!
Well, I've never seen such a horror in my life. Can you imagine me with a zombie wife?
Yes!
Back to back, belly in the belly, well, I don't give a damn, cause I've done that a bit. Back to back, belly in the belly, empty zombie chat.
We're in here all alone, you know.
Back to back, belly in the belly, well, I don't give a damn, cause I've done that a bit. Back to back, belly in the belly, empty zombie chat.
The Kingston Trio from The Hungry Eye. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Keith R.A.D. Candido, who just read the short story. What was the name of that again?
The short story is called Under the King's Bridge.
Yeah,
which that's will be
fun.
Thank you. It'll be appearing in an anthology called Liar Liar, which will be released by Mendacity Press, which is a small press that is publishing this anthology.
That has a lot of mendacity.
Indeed. I'm not sure when exactly it will be available. Sometime this fall.
Yeah, but if people go to your website...
If they go to decandido.net,
which is spelled... How do you spell
that, Keith? Spelled DECANDIDO.NET. There will be... Once it's available...
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you spell that for me again?
I've been spelling it for 42 years. I ought to be able to by now.
You've been spelling your website for 42 years?
No, I've been spelling my last name for 42 years,
Okay, yes. Yeah.
D-E, because whenever I say, hi, I'm Keith, my name is Keith DeCandido. Can you spell that? To which my answer is usually, I ought to be able to by
net,
now.
Yes.
No, it's DECANDIDO.net. That is the portal to
all things
Keith, including, and once Liar Liar is available for pre-order, a link will go up on DeCandido.net for that. Currently, what's up there directly?
Unicorn Precinct.
Unicorn Precinct, SCPD, The Case of the Claw or the Craw. And you really have totally ruined that title for me.
I will never
forgive that. And also, I also wrote a novel based on Dungeons & Dragons, the role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Under the Crimson Sun. Which
a lot of things under things.
Yeah, I've been having... It's weird. It's like there was a period there where I had a whole bunch of books.
Nobody's over the King's Bridge.
No,
nobody's over it.
I go through these phases
and
like
said,
I had...
Get over it, Jim.
Yeah. I had three Star Trek novels that all started with an indefinite article. There was A Burning House, there was A Singular Destiny, and there was A Gutted World. And all three of them were actually from quotes from other sources, so it just worked out that way. And now I've got Unicorn Precinct, I've got Under the King's Bridge, I've got Under the Crimson Sun. It's like all these U titles all of a sudden. It's just I don't understand it.
It's you. But,
indeed. That's not a me, that's a you.
It's not you, it's me.
Yes.
Yes. If you, the listener, would like to call up and speak with Keith DeCandido. Oh, God, I am tied-tongued. Here.
Indeed.
You can give a phone call to WBAI at 212-209-2900 and we will entertain calls for a while. We have about 10 minutes left before
yes.
we have to go to outro music.
Yes.
And
we'll see if anybody calls.
Oh, well, they're calling.
I've also there's one other story I want to mention that's coming out while we wait for somebody to call, which I actually considered reading at the Nursef reading in tonight, but in both cases it was too long because it's a 12,000-word story.
Mm.
Deborah Grabian has put together an anthology called Tales from the House Band, which it's a collection of stories about music, as with Liar Liar, there's a variety.
She was
of
on the show a few years ago. I hope she comes back because she's a West Coaster.
Yeah, she's out in San Francisco.
Yeah,
and it'd be great to have her on. She's Deb's an old buddy of mine.
Yeah, she's been here. She's been here, but
and,
I want her back.
Yes. I'll let her know that.
Do that,
I'm sure she'll be coming. I know we're going to be doing stuff. When Tales of the House Band is released in November, I know she's going to be doing a bunch of different things to promote it.
Get her here.
I will do what I can.
I'll put her on the air.
Madeline Robbins also has a story in it.
Hey, Maddie.
And hers is actually, Mads is the lead story. It's called The Boy Who Played Air Guitar.
Yeah, I saw her for the first time in about 10 years since she moved.
She's also in San Francisco. It's like
but she was in New Yorker, and she had been on the show before she left. But
and my story, it's called Ragnarok and Roll.
Of course,
it's a modern urban fantasy. It takes place in Key West, Florida. It's actually one of several stories involving a young female weirdness magnate named Cassie Zukov, And I've got a bunch of other stories with her that I'm hoping will see the light of day soon. But Ragnarok and Roll, it takes place, as I said, in Key West, Florida, and involves rock and roll, scuba diving, the coming of Ragnarok, and beer. So
there we go.
Yeah.
And hopefully there are no Thor jokes.
Amazingly enough, no. Thor does not appear in this particular story. There's other people from Norse mythology do show up.
Very good.
But not Thor.
Good.
If anybody's ever been to Captain Tony's Saloon in Key West,
believe it or not, I'm not well traveled, but I have been.
You know how there's a saloon in the story called Mayor Fred's Saloon, which is patterned after Captain Tony's, including the fact that it's built around a giant ficus tree, which is used to be Key West hanging tree, actually.
Yeah.
Not far
from Hemingway's house, as I recall.
Yeah. In fact, what is now Captain Tony's is now the site that originally Sloppy Joe's was built on. They then moved it over to Duval Street. And then Captain Tony's opened, and like I said, in the story, it's called Mayor Fred's. And the ficus around which it is built is also one of the roots of Yggdrasil, the world tree from Norse mythology.
Ah, of course.
Yes.
Good morning. You're on the radio with Keith DeCandido.
Yep. Hi, Jim. I have a special request.
Yes?
I'm going to ask Keith a question, and I'm going to ask you not to talk over him, because you always talk over your guests. Keith, my question is, I actually grew up in Riverdale, and I know the Marble Hill area very well, and I wonder if you could go on for a couple of minutes about combining a real-world location and utter fantasy, which I thought was a great story. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I was born, raised, educated, and still live in the Bronx, and one of the... in addition to the short story I read, I'm actually in the midst of working on a novel with Bram Gold as the main character. And it takes place in the Bronx, and there's a lot of history there in that particular borough. And in a lot of ways, the Bronx is kind of not quite the forgotten borough. I mean, the real forgotten borough is Staten Island, but that's forgotten for a reason. You know, whenever people talk...
What borough?
Yeah, exactly. People very rarely... Usually when people think about New York, they think primarily about Manhattan, obviously. In fact, most people don't even realize there's more to it beyond Manhattan. If they really want to get crazy, it'll be Brooklyn. You know, sometimes Queens. The Bronx is almost always ignored or left out or forgotten.
I will talk over you because it's my show.
Okay.
But I just wanted to say that growing up in Queens and now living in Brooklyn, I used to hate it when people say, I'm going to the city.
Yeah. Oh, that makes
me
crazy.
You're already there.
Yeah, that makes me crazy too. But Bram works in the Bronx primarily, and it's to actually answer the caller's question, it's a lot of fun doing that. First of all, I love writing about New York City. A bunch of my novels have taken place in New York. Some, like the two Spider-Man novels, obviously. The first Supernatural novel I wrote actually also took place in the Bronx, where I made use. It was called Nevermore, and it actually made use of the Poe Cottage. In fact, the Bronx Historical Society were very nice and gave me a tour of the Poe Cottage and told me about some of the history of it and whatnot. And it's fun to incorporate that stuff. There's enough history and enough mythology and enough storytelling that relates to the city in general and the Bronx in particular that it's a very fertile ground for writing things. And the particular history of Marble Hill, with it being, you know, an island for a while and originally part of Manhattan, and still, politically speaking, it's still part of Manhattan, technically.
That's right. There's that weird
thing. It used to be part of Manhattan until they cut, you know, everything I said in the story is absolutely true. They cut through and then they filled in the top part. So it's now part of the Bronx physically, but it used to be part of Manhattan.
Right.
And they still want to be part of Manhattan. Although interestingly enough, if you call the cops from Marble Hill, it's the 50th precinct in the Bronx that will come and help you out. So, but it's fun to take the stuff that's already there that you see outside the window and incorporate fantastic elements into it. So,
all righty. Let's take another call. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello. Could I speak to the guest?
You're on the air now.
Pardon?
You're on the air.
Okay. Keith, I have a question. When you say you write about Spider-Man and Star Trek, isn't there a problem with the copyright laws?
No. These are all...
This is licensed.
Yeah, this is all licensed tie-in fiction where the way it generally works is a book publisher will buy the rights from, in the case of Spider-Man, Marvel Comics, in the case of Star Trek, CBS Paramount. If it's Star Wars, it'd be Lucasfilms. Whoever actually owns the property, the publisher will buy the rights to publish books from that copyright holder, and then the books will get published. If you go to a bookstore, you'll see, you know, Star Trek novels or Star Wars novels or novels based on various things.
So, in other words, a license is required,
yes,
and it has been paid.
Yeah, but that's done by the people who publish the books, and then they turn around and hire writers like me and others to do those books. So it's all right. This is all stuff that is completely above board and legal.
So that means you do get permission from the publishers.
Oh yes, absolutely.
The publishers are the people hiring him. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that answers my question because. Yes. I mean, if somebody writes nowadays, you know, comic books, and they base the story on something that's already there, I thought they needed permission. But now that you tell me, yeah, that's what you already got, it answers my question. Thank you very much.
Okay,
you're
thank
very
you.
Welcome. Yeah,
you
thank
have
you.
A nice night.
Have a great morning right, or bye. Night. Take care.
Whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of them.
I haven't been to bed yet.
Good
so it's
morning.
Night.
You are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. DeCanada, what a spiffy story, considering it's adjacent to my own neighborhood. That bus your hero was riding down must have been the 7 or the 100.
It was the 7.
Yes. I know it quite well. Now, all the lot, by the way, thank you, James, for playing those two cuts. They couldn't have been any better chosen, especially Zombie Jamboree. My God.
Well, there is no Lamprey Jamboree, so.
Yeah, that's the best we could do.
1958, Hungry Eye, San Francisco. Oh, classic. Anyway, Liars Club, are all the stories based on that? Based sort of urban fantasy, or do you go into the realm of, you know, tall tales, that sort of thing?
The genres represented in the Liar anthology are multitudinous, and actually mine is the only urban fantasy in the bunch. There's a couple of straight up horror stories. Mm. There's some adventure stories. One is actually Jonathan Mayberry's story is a Sherlock Holmes pastiche.
Ooh.
Greg Frost's novel is actually a Dracula pastiche that where Abraham Van Helsing is the main character.
Oh, really?
So we've got another story. We actually got three stories that take place in the 19th century. The other one is one involving canal digging in northern New York.
You mean Erie Canal?
Yeah.
Oh my.
And there's, you know, straight up domestic horror, ghost stories, things like that. The only common theme that links all the stories together is the theme of lying.
So
in some form or other.
So you're basically,
that's not true.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, remember, as someone once said to me, even if it never happened, it's all true.
Exactly.
So this sounds like fun. I mean, I'm looking forward to this book very, very much.
Thank you.
And so keep up the good work and keep riding that number 7 bus.
Yes.
Get good ideas.
Okay, we're running
Bye.
Short on time.
Thank
Take
you.
Care. Yeah, we have under a minute left.
Sorry.
Wouldn't you know? Don't be sorry. I'm sorry that we only have that minute left. So how do you spell that website again?
It's www.decandido.net, which will lead you to ordering information for my books. It will lead you to my accounts on both Facebook and Twitter, as well as my blog. And I also I'm involved with a couple of podcasts, including my own podcast, which is called Dead Kitchen Radio, which is an anagram of Keith R. A. DeCandido.
Ah, and that's cute.
Thank you. I have Teresa Nielsen Hayden to thank for that. And I also am involved with the Chronic Rift, which is a pop culture podcast that airs every week. And
I was on the TV show.
Yes, back when it was a TV show.
Is that
show.
When I met you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it was. And I also am involved with a zombie apocalypse audio drama called HG World, where I play the character of Todd Rage, who is, ironically, an AM radio host.
AM.
In fact, he's an elderly, right-wing Vietnam veteran radio show host.
It's all the opposites. I'm FM music.
Yes, I know. But this is why they call it acting. And it's called HG World, and it's actually up for a Parsec Award, which I hope we win. So.
Very cool.
So again, that's DeCandido, DeCandido.net.
And the Unicorn Precinct, that's
yes.
the title I remember, and the other
is
new book.
Is called SCPD, The Case of the Claw.
All righty. So, again, thank you. We must do this more often.
We
it's
must,
a lot of
yes.
fun. And thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Stay tuned for Burn, Baby, Burn Clappers with Lister. And I will be back next week, Wednesday night, from 1:30 to 3 a.m. with, well, it can't be told yet. Actually, there are a couple of possibilities, including very possibly a broadcast of L.A. Banks. So
it's TBD again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. Take care. Have a good morning.
Frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Djelovanje takvog uma, koji ima potencijal da iz mase ignoranta izdigne se za ideal, uništava te svetski poredak koji degradira smisao čovjeka što ne ume da mu parira. Varanje varira, količine bunog stanja, ako previše znaš, postaješ breme delovana, jer ne ide u prilog nekim ođima i sebi, uzdizanje svesti kolektiva ili jedinke.
Samo u kalupljene prednike, za sebe oni žele. Dozvoljavaš li ambiciji da se tome preda? Da si mudar ko Spinoza, hrabar kao Galileo. Ti bih hteo, ali uvek nešto koči, nikad ne da. Sistem, koliko ofucano zvuči, misliš opet kreće priča o prilikama okruženja. Neću pričati o tome, svi mi znamo kako je, od šta se menja. Zajebi neki sekundu svoje sjećanja. Pojte da je bilo dobro, svoje pojmove generišu u odnosu na model kakvog stanja, da su zbrinuti u momentu. A što će biti s nama kada snovi odu? Molim, istina je prava da su ljudi uspavani. Opravki neka zna si sredstvo vas manipulacije. Menjalo je oblik, suština mu je ista. Zadržati vlas i kontrolisati nacije.
Politika, korupcija, teror, destrukcija, rasista i sve.
When I leave you with my head, left words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
The show is dedicated to Joel Chen.
The red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself. Torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledged allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right. Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Cause my hurt is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. Took the flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee dude. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, 7 minutes after 3 o'clock. WBAI.org. Breaking news right here. Stop the music. Breaking news right here. Joel Chin has been murdered, executed in Kingston, Jamaica. 3 bullets to the head, close range, outside of his home in Kilsum, Jamaica. This has broken my heart. What says you at 212-209-2900? Definitely, this is a case of a failed state. We're going to be dedicating the entire show to Joel Chin. He's an important individual. Sadly enough, it was not breaking enough news on WBAI. And that breaks my heart. Big time. Big time. Big time. So sad. So sad. He grew up in my arms. Now he's executed and dead. Protecting, we're all part of this reality. Dedicating the show to his mother. He's on her way to go bury her son and kill some Jamaica right about now. Clive Chin's son, Pat Chin's grandson, Randy Chin's nephew, Chris Chin's nephew. I am distraught, broken up, devastated. Joel Chin, this is for you. JBB for Joel Chin right here. Sky Juice is falling from listeners' eyes. Sky Juice is murdered in a failed state called Kill Some JA. The dirty secrets of Jamaica. Tourist board won't tell you that. You know why, right? 90.1 FM, list on the radio right here. The show is called Burn Baby Burn. It's dedicated to Joel Chin, who is responsible for acts like this. Shaggy. Joel Chin did the world for Shaggy, made him as big as he is. Sean Paul, he discovered, and the rest is history. 90.1 FM in Stony Brook, his favorite radio station, a cornerstone of the reggae marathon out in Stony Brook. Joel Chin will cry for you.
Girl, I love open up and let me in. We could do most anything. Tell me, do you like a swing? Baby, can I do my thing? Girl, I love the vibe you bring. Open up and let me in. We could do most anything. Tell me, do you tell me you're not here? Put the reggae lover where you run things this year. New tune favors on me, I've lyrics to spare. No need to fear. Girl, if you're done with this, the lover, put your finger on the ear. I love you all. And I even like the runchy ways that you talk. You're the kind of girl that on the fellas.